A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations and institutions. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, we'll head over to Broadway for a look behind the scenes at how the soundscape of a stage production comes to life. Composer and sound designer Dan Moses Schreier has been nominated for a Tony Award in the sound design category this year for his work in the revival of the Eugene O'Neill play The Iceman Cometh, and I'll speak with him about his work on that and other productions. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. The National Endowment for the Arts has named Sarah C. Nash as its new director of dance. In the role, Nash will be responsible for representing the agency at dance-related conferences and will also oversee the NEA grants to support dance programs and organizations. She was most recently program director for dance at the New England Foundation for the Arts and has also served as senior producer at Dance Theater Workshop and manager of the U.S. Artists International Grant Program at Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation. Yannick Nézet-Séguin, music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra and incoming music director at the Metropolitan Opera, has a new exclusive recording deal with Deutsche Grammophon, extending the recording relationship he has had with the Yellow Label for a decade. According to a statement from Deutsche Grammophon, the new agreement will include recordings with the Philadelphia Orchestra of Mahler's Symphony No. 8 and all the Rachmaninoff symphonies and piano concertos featuring soloist Daniil Trifonov. Deutsche Grammophon also plans to record albums featuring Nézet-Séguin performing with the Metropolitan Opera. The label has already released recordings of the conductor leading the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Metropolitan Opera, and the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra, which will be featured in an upcoming CD set that will be released this month. In other recording news, Jurassic Park actor Jeff Goldblum has signed on with Decca Records as a jazz pianist. According to a release from Decca parent company Universal Music Group, Goldblum has performed with his jazz band, the Mildred Snitzer Orchestra, in Los Angeles and New York City for several decades, and last year accompanied soul jazz artist Gregory Porter on the BBC's Graham Norton Show. He also hosts a weekly jazz variety show in Los Angeles. More details on the album will be released in the future. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world.
You made me down until my soul within me died. You've shattered each and every dream. You pulled me from the start. And though you're not true, may God bless you. When
the curtain rises on a Broadway production, all eyes are on the stage, taking in the intricate or sometimes Spartan set design and waiting for the entrances of the stars. But what about your ears? Sound design is a critical part of bringing a production together, from the incidental music and the way the actors' voices are mic'd to any other acoustic magic needed to transport you inside the play or the musical. That's where the sound designer comes in. Dan Moses Schreier has spent more than three decades in this world of sound. He has composed music for productions including The Snow Geese in 2013 and The Merchant of Venice in 2011, and worked in sound design on the 50th anniversary production of West Side Story, the 2010 production of A Little Night Music, and most recently, the revival of Eugene O'Neill's play The Iceman Cometh, now playing at the Bernard R. Jacobs Theater. His work on that play has been nominated for a Tony Award this year, his fifth Tony nomination in his career. You just heard the recording of the song The Curse of the Aching Heart, taken from a 1913 Edison cylinder recording that Schreier found and incorporated into the production at the top of Act 4. I spoke with him recently about his work on The Iceman Cometh and how he initially approaches the task of creating the oral atmosphere of a production.
I always begin with the text, really a thorough reading of the play and trying to understand the intent of the author and what are the dramatic arguments being made in a play. So that's really where I begin. I read the play first. And then the second thing is then I usually meet with the director and we discuss his vision of the text, of what his approach and his ideas about how he would like to interpret the play. And that's the beginning of the groundwork for creating a soundscape or sound design for a play on Broadway or anywhere else in the theater across the country.
Well, now currently playing on Broadway is The Iceman Cometh, and you've received a Tony nomination for the sound design in that. What were some of the specific issues you needed to address in that?
The work is twofold. On a very technical level, the first issue is miking the stage so that the voices of the actors can be amplified so they can be heard evenly throughout the space. So there's a very technical part of the job. And that's the first thing that I try to tackle. And once that is accomplished, and it's also important for maybe people who don't know a lot about the Broadway theater, is that when you start a production on Broadway, you go into the theater, it's bare walls. There is nothing in the theater. So for every single production that you do on Broadway, you have to bring in every single piece of gear or every set piece, every piece of lighting, every speaker, you know, the backstage intercom paging system that has to be brought in for every single show. So there's a very technical side of what I do is in that it's actually drafting and designing the sound system that will be brought into the Broadway theater.
Wow.
So that's the first part of the job. And also many of those decisions in terms of designing the sound system for a theater will be based on the text of the play and the needs of the play and what the director's vision for the play is. So you, that's what leads you to which kind of speakers you want to use, what kind of microphones you want to use. It leads to the beginning of the research of what the soundscape for the play will be. So once the technical side of placing them into the microphones, and based on the discussions I had with George Wolf concerning The Iceman Cometh, he wanted the soundscape to recreate the world of 1912 Lower Broadway in Manhattan. One of the themes of the play is that Harry Hope, who is the owner of the bar in which the action takes place, has not left the bar for 20 years since the death of his wife. And one of the reasons he's afraid to go outside is in those 20 years, the Industrial Revolution starts happening. And New York City, which was a place that was all about horses and carriages, became a city filled with automobiles. And Harry Hope had this phobia that if he'd go outside, he'd be killed by an automobile. And George Wolfe was interested in bringing the idea of the industrial age into the soundscape of the theater.
So then with those challenges, how did you do that? And what is the experience like for those in the audience?
In terms of making the sounds of New York oppressive, George decided that in one of the transitions, the transition into Act Three, in which all the denizens of the bar start confronting what the lead character, Hickey, calls their pipe dreams, in Act Three, they're all forced to sort of face them and face the reality of their lives. And in that scene is also the scene where Harry Hope goes out of the bar for the first time since his wife died. So to start the scene off, I created this sort of surround sound soundscape of just the industrial side of New York City at that time. There were steam locomotive subways that were elevated trains that were in the city at the turn of the century. It's the first automobiles were on the streets of New York. And of course, there are no rules. Like if you look at movies of this time period, you see automobiles just swerving right and left. There's no dividing line. I mean, there's a kind of chaos that you see in these films from this era, and I tried to recreate that in sound as you enter Act Three.
I understand that there was also, in terms of the music, that Eugene O'Neill had actually put together a songbook that you could reference. How did that help you, and what were some of the ways that you used your own thoughts to bring that together?
There is something called the Eugene O'Neill Songbook, which O'Neill himself put together for all the songs that are sung in all of his plays. And there is a section that deals with, it's like, I think 15 songs that are mentioned or sung during the course of Iceman Cometh that Eugene O'Neill lists in the songbook. And George Wolfe started by having Janine Tesori, the composer, come into rehearsal and teach each character one of the songs that George thought identified somehow an aspect of their character. And so when I heard those recordings of Janine playing things back for the actors, I thought, you know, this is 1910, 1915. Thomas Edison had already invented the phonograph. So I did think about, well, I bet you if I do a lot of deep research, there are recordings of some of these songs in the songbook on Edison cylinders. This is before CDs, before vinyl, before 78s. Recordings were sold commercially on these wax cylinders. And it's the first time that people had recorded music in their houses, that it was available to people on a mass consumer level, similar to the Model T for cars, Ford Motors in the car. And I did, in my research, I found 11 of the songs, their original recordings on Edison cylinders spanning from the years 1908 to 1913. So I found those original recordings and I brought those to George and I said, I really think we could use these because they really help create the atmosphere. It makes you understand and hear the sonic world of, you know, the turn of the century in the early teens by hearing these very old recordings. And George liked that so much that we ended up using one of the recordings to get us into Act Four.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that one of the themes going through this play, particularly with Harry, is this challenge and struggle with change, particularly in this case, technological change, and the way that can truly upend somebody's life, and especially if they don't stay up to date with things that are going on. And undoubtedly, I would guess in your career, you have seen a number of technological shifts that has totally changed the way you might approach a work. How has technology changed the way you do your work and what you can do in the theater?
Well, you're totally correct that in the course of my career, I have seen this amazing revolution from analog recording techniques that actually begin with Thomas Edison and the Edison cylinder, going to leading eventually to magnetic tape in the 50s and the 60s, which is still analog. And then in college, it was the beginning of the digital revolution where we started seeing for the first time with the advent of the personal computer that, you know, in your home or in your studio, you could use your laptop to start recording material digitally. And then it became a thing where you were able to play back sounds digitally. So when I started my career in the theater, you were playing back and creating soundscapes using reel-to-reel tape decks. And then now everything that I do in the theater is controlled by computers, except for the mixer physically mixing the show and using his ears to make sure things sound right. Everything to the point to the mixer is now controlled by computers. So there's been a radical revolution. And what you can do with those computers in the theater now is amazing, what you could not do before with analog tape.
Now, are there any downsides to that?
No. I mean, there are some people who they get into this argument, oh, well, analog sounds better than digital, but in the theater, first of all, the noise floor of any theater is so high that the gain that you get from the quiet of, or being able to distinguish between, well, analog sounds better than digital, really disappears because theaters are inherently noisy spaces. Downside? No, I can't think of a one, in the sense that I'm able to create very complex soundscapes in the theater extremely quickly now with the digital tools that I have. And I can manipulate things for the director in real time by like the way a soundscape moves around the theater, or like when I did a production of Into the Woods with James Lapine many years ago, the revival, and we were able to move the giant. The sensation was the giant moved through the theater as the giant was approaching the cast on stage. And that stuff you really couldn't do before in the analog world. And now you can do those things and do them relatively fast. And that is no going back.
Hmm. Well, one thing that I've heard a lot and seen in terms of B-rolls and heard from other reviewers from time to time, particularly in, I'd say, musicals, especially if the score is highly pop-based or a pop genre, and that's really the balance between the music versus the vocals. In fact, one of the more common things I'll hear when sound design is mentioned is, you know, it would have been nice if we could have heard what the actors were saying. And I'm talking obviously generally. But what are the challenges, especially now when you do have characters who are, or actors who are mic'd, which changes the way things were, but how do you find that balance?
It's really complicated. And it takes, going back to the idea of the digital revolution, now that you have so much in terms of, now we're talking about musicals as opposed to a play like The Iceman Cometh. In many of these pop orchestras or electronic orchestras, you now have all these synthesizers. And balancing the synthesizers internally in terms of the patch changing and the switches and the textures it's creating with, let's say, live acoustic instruments or eventually with the vocals, takes enormous amount of work and takes enormous amount of skill, and it's not a very easy thing to do. And I understand the complaints that audience members have, but if you do it right and you take the time and you're given the time to do the balancing correctly, you can make it sound actually quite spectacular. A couple years ago, I did a show with Duncan Shink called American Psycho, and that show, what was really interesting about it is, or one of the many things that was interesting about American Psycho was the orchestra consisted of two laptop computers. Mm. And that may have been a first on Broadway. And all of the music was based on 1980s sequenced synth pop, because that is the era that the book American Psycho is portraying. And Duncan, by design, thought that to make the music appropriate for the musical, it should be that synth pop. It should be sequenced. And he used a program called Ableton Live, which is a very flexible kind of sequencer where it can take cue. It doesn't just play things back from start to finish. It's able to like play beginning of something and then go into a loop and then release from the loop and continue playing so that you can follow the actors. And it was an amazing experience for me I'm also a composer and a musician, to be able to work that way in the theater. And it was all being generated by two laptop computers. And that show was loud. I mean, it had scenes that took place in, like the dance clubs in the 80s in Lower Manhattan. So those clubs were very, very loud environments. So whenever we went to clubs, the show got very, very loud. But that was part of the character of it. It wasn't just loud to be loud. It was really about, it's an aspect of the storytelling. And that's what good sound design can do, in many, many different ways. But in the case of American Psycho, volume was actually part of the character of the piece. Hmm. So that's how sound design can, help tell the story, which is what I hope I'm doing the most as a sound designer, is I'm trying to be a storyteller in my way to help the director create his vision of how he wants the story to be told of a particular play.
Hmm. Well, I was wondering then, are there times when the sound design is best when it actually goes unnoticed?
The answer is yes to that. That, and here again, another example from the kinds of work that I've done in the past. I've had the good fortune of designing and working with Stephen Sondheim and doing many, many of his musicals. The first was the revival of Into the Woods that I spoke about. There was I worked on the revival of Passion, Pacific Overtures, a lot of them, and I did the Road Show, which was a premiere of a new musical of Steve's, and now those shows, the aim is the opposite of American Psycho. And in American Psycho, because of the language of the music, the sound system became a character. When I'm working on a Stephen Sondheim musical, the inverse happens, like the question you asked. But the point of one of my roles as a sound designer is to make the sound system as transparent as possible so that you even create the illusion that they aren't even being mic'd. And it's a whole different aesthetic, sort of something more grounded in classical music in the opera world and less in the pop world.
Right. I should credit our theater critic, Howard Shapiro, for asking me that question. Okay. I turn to the experts on this. Well, I'm curious, what was it in particular that drew you in the first place to sound design?
In college, I studied music, and I studied music composition. I started my studies at the University of Michigan with a gentleman named William Bolcom, and I studied with him for a year, and then after my year, I got a job that brought me to New York. But in my time at the University of Michigan, and after I took a year off to work professionally, I decided to go back to school. Then I went to school at Columbia. Both places had electronic music studios. Now, this is before the digital revolution. So these were rooms that were filled with tape decks, reel-to-reel tape decks, amplifiers, speakers, but also with, you know, the Moog synthesizer or a Buchla synthesizer. These are the very beginnings of electronic music. And in my studies, which involved, you know, more of a classical approach of, you know, learning orchestration and learning Bach fugue writing or whatever, I was fascinated by the electronic music studio, which was a different way to be thinking about music. And it was my interest in the electronic music studio that became what we now sort of call sound design in the theater, before there was such a thing called sound design in the theater. So it began with my interest in electronic music and that studio. You know, people like Stockhausen and Boulez, who were experimenting with the computer and before the computer was definitely analog, sampling and tape manipulation that then became computer manipulation. That's the whole fascinated me.
Mm. And now, how often are you able to bring your compositions into your stage work as well?
I'd say it's about 50-50. And I view them as sort of all being on the same continuum in a funny way, in the sense that, you know, both my skills as a composer and my skills as a sound designer, it's all about organizing sound and time. They're both ultimately the same job, but they manifest themselves in very different ways. So most recently, I think the best known compositional work of mine was that I wrote the score for Al Pacino's Merchant of Venice that was on Broadway about 6 or 7 years ago now. Last summer, I wrote a full-length evening piece called Demolishing Everything with Amazing Speed that was presented by the Holland Festival in Amsterdam last summer. So my entire career has been going back and forth between doing composing and then doing sound design, sometimes doing both for a play or a musical. But I'm always mixing it up, and for me, that's great because it's always interesting.
Well, The Iceman Cometh has been nominated for a Tony in sound design. Any thoughts on what warranted the Tony or the nomination? I mean, I guess that's always, awards are always sometimes a very,
you know,
rare...
I don't know how to answer that. I just do my work, you know, and it happened. And it's been a lovely experience. What particularly, I mean, I hope it's that they were attracted to, that all the sonic choices help tell the storytelling. That's what I hope.
You know, one issue that's comes to the forefront from time to time in the news, particularly from the musician side of things, is the shift in theater from live orchestras to electronic canned or electronic synthesizer. How has that affected your work, and do you have a preference when it comes to that aspect of it?
You know, my personal philosophy and take on that is that the story of music history is on a parallel track with the story of the technology of making music. You know, so in the medieval times, certain instruments were loud and they were able to fill a cathedral. And then in the era of the court, we got these smaller forms like string quartets and the smaller versions of the early symphonies. And then with the development of the rise of the middle class, the construction of orchestral halls, then orchestras became larger, and you got the works of Strauss or the very early, you know, like Gurley or Schoenberg, where they have these immense orchestras, enormous size, that created this enormous volume. Then with the rise of, let's say, even like the electric guitar, you were able to create the volume of 101 musicians acoustically with Gurley with a rock trio and amplifiers. So there's always this relationship between music history and music technology. And so I just see where we're going is a natural growth of what's happening in music. I mean, I have kids, and I would say that maybe 5% of the music they listen to is acoustic. 95% of the music that they listen to is electronic, in the sense they're listening to their iPads, they're listening through headphones, or they're listening to a CD or a tune that's downloaded that's electronic, you know. So that is the way music is being consumed right now by a majority of people, at least in our culture. So I don't see this as a good thing or as a bad thing. I just see it as the natural flow of things. So to go from a Sondheim musical to that's a beautifully orchestrated by Jonathan Tunick that has a 25-piece orchestra that is like, the sound is like sumptuous and gorgeous, a little night music, just beautiful, to doing American Psycho on Broadway, which is just two laptop computers. I love it all. I embrace it all. It's just what it is. And I think they're both beautiful. That's my viewpoint.
That was composer and sound designer Dan Moses Schreier, whose work on the revival of Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh was nominated for a Tony Award in the sound design category. This year's Tony Awards will be broadcast Sunday, June 10th on CBS at 8 p.m. You can find Schreier's website at danmosesschreier.com, and his last name is spelled S-C-H-R-E-I-E-R. And the website of the Broadway production is icemanonbroadway.com. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on Autempo, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to Autempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. Autempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.